welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remmler. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Today's podcast originates from the annual meeting of the Society for Values in Higher Education, held this year at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. Joining me is Kelly Baker, who is here as this year's Mary Jo Small Fellow, an honor bestowed to rising scholars who show uncommon promise as both educators and authors. Kelly teaches religious studies and American studies at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. Today we'll be discussing her new book, Gospel According to the Klan, The Ku Klux Klan's Appeal to Protestant America, 1915 to 1930, published by the University Press of Kansas in 2011. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, first, tell us what prompted you to write this, as you call it, history of an unloved group.
I think part of the reason I did this is because there are so many histories of loved groups. It's kind of a contrary statement, but one of the things that I was interested in this project was seeing how historical norms and narrativity and also approaches and ethics are different when we look at groups that are considered unloved, so hate groups, white supremacist movements, the Klan, groups that we normally don't want to be empathetic towards or don't want to understand because it makes us nervous, and trying to really problematize our understandings of which groups are suitable for study and which groups aren't. And I, as you know, make a claim in this book that unloved groups are really important groups to study because of the way we try to sort of present them as larger than life and make them somehow evil or somehow bad. And this means they're unapproachable. And what I want to say is that when we really get into it, what we realize is the situation is much more complicated and we can't make these kinds of value judgments to impede analysis.
Did you ever have that moment where you sort of woke up and said, why am I doing this?
I think when I first heard someone refer to me at a conference as that Klan girl, I had a clear moment of maybe I had been marked by my subject matter in a way that I was not entirely happy with. So periodically throughout the project, I had to think really really deeply about what it meant that I was so identified with the study of white supremacist movements, right? And the sort of agonizing that then causes for me to think through, like, categories of white supremacist and racist, and what does it mean to be somehow stigmatized and study stigmatized knowledge? And, I mean, it's this kind of joke in our family that my partner in crime enjoys, in which he likes to introduce me at parties as that person that studies the Klan and then just sort of watch the discontents as they happen. So, I mean, I periodically still have these kinds of pangs of, like, what does it mean that I spent my life for years and years on the Klan, right, as opposed to spending my life on something that might have been more positive or utopian or progressive? It really is a sort of interestingly dangerous question, I think, that I'm not, I mean, every once in a while I wake up and I confront students and they're like, you work on really weird things, and I say, indeed, right, I'm a really strange person.
Well, let's get into the content of the book then, because you really do uniquely foreground the Klan's Protestantism. So why did you do this, and what do you think this uniquely contributes to Klan historiography?
So what I discovered very early on in the project is that Klan historians are remarkably good at tracing things like nationalism. They're remarkably good at tracing particular individual claverns, which is their fancy talk for basically local chapters. And they do a very nice job of those kinds of histories, right? So it's sort of demarcating groups and time and place, thinking really deeply about 100% Americanism. What frustrated me about this historiography is that they would throw around labels like that the Klan was pseudo-Christian or that they were fundamentalist or that they might have been Protestant, but really it's pseudo-religion, right? And so there was no critical inquiry into, one, why they wanted to claim the Klan was pseudo-religion, but two, to think either very deeply about what it meant that the Klan was continually calling themselves Protestant, right? They spend a lot of time talking about not only 100% Americanism, but also that what they're looking for is a white Protestant nation. And so what I felt my book adds then is a really detailed study of how they mobilize, define, and deploy that term, and that it's not actually pseudo-religion, but it's what I would consider very much a religious expression, that they're not just sort of putting this as a gloss on their nationalism, but these are folks that are really thinking deeply about what it means to be Protestant and go through a lot of ink, actually, and sort of labeling and describing what it means to be Protestant. I mean, these are folks that pretty much imagine that Christian history starts with Jesus and then nothing happens, and then there's Luther, right? I mean, so it tells you something about their anti-Catholicism, too, and how they define Christianity. And so that's what I feel like my niche is with this book, is to give a religious studies perspective to a historiography that lacked it.
And along with that, when we think about the Klan, we think about violence, we think about hate, and there is this assumption that those are aberrations. Those are things that demarcate the Klan as inauthentically
religious.
But you kind of take another angle on that.
And I understand the impulse to do that. I mean, one of the things that I would say is that I thought really deeply in this book about how much I wanted to document violence and how much I didn't want to document violence, and how much I wanted to sort of see from inside Klan constructions of the world versus, you know, sort of outsiders who are viewing them. And one of the things that becomes clear to me is that violence, and other historians support this too, with the 1920s Klan is an aberration, right? That when people are violent, there are these certain actions that are terrorist actions that we can very much talk about, but most of the violence is actually rhetorical, so that when we look at what they're doing and what they're conjuring, it's these rhetorical battles, and it's battles over nationalism that have implicit violence, and those, I feel like, are sometimes more insidious. They're harder to track, they're harder to understand their impact, but the way they use rhetoric is one of the things that was most intriguing to me about this project, because they understand so clearly, like, how you position yourself and create your world through words, or the world that you want to have in some way. And so it gets to the violence and intolerance, but it also shows that a lot of their concerns are the same concerns as other Americans in the 1920s. So while we want to say that the Klan is somehow exceptional, I think it's harder and harder to make that case based on the evidence and archival information that we have, where it actually shows that they look really similar to other white evangelicals in this time period. And so it was interesting for me to get to that place too, right? To say what makes them sort of dramatic is costuming and theatricality and burning crosses. But when we look at their ideology, I mean, it's kind of hauntingly similar, which makes people intriguingly nervous, right, about this.
I want to follow up on the sources, because you're talking about how rhetoric is so important to the construction of their identity. Now, you used the print media of the Klan. How did you go about using this, and what do you say to someone who might dismiss this evidence as mere propaganda?
It's a really good question, and it's when I still still confront and manage this sort of larger historiographical track of this, is that lots of other Klan historians have looked at these documents. Lots of Klan historians have completely dismissed them as just propaganda. Like, somehow propaganda means we're not going to use them because they're not trustworthy, right? And they're very much conjuring the space, and that this is somehow more a production, right, than it is authentic feelings or something like this. I'm not going to debate about that one way or another. I mean, when the thing that was interesting to me then is to say, okay, so they might be propaganda, but it's meaningful propaganda. So to look at the cues in their print about what they're trying to do. I mean, one of the funniest kind of things for me was to read, you know, read these sort of copious amount of print culture, like filing cases full of this, but, you know, to sort of read along with them and see that the kind of thing that the print allows us is we see where they see that they're successful, but also the things that make them really nervous and anxious and desperate. So that almost every issue had something about Protestantism, where they're continually understanding that they're fighting a battle to show that they're Protestant, at the same time that they don't want to claim that they're a church, right? But they're also fighting really pragmatic battles, like, for the love of goodness, Klansmen, keep your visors down. Like, how hard is it for us? We tell you this, right, in instruction manuals. We tell you this at meetings. For the love of goodness, we can't be a secret order, right, if you're going around with your visor up. So it's this kind of, like, funny space where you get to see them work out some of this stuff, and some of it that doesn't get fulfilled, some of it that does, their spin on events, right, and their sort of claims of cultural success. So I found them to be really rich sources that you did have to bring an amount of suspicion with, but they couldn't be discarded.
Well, to kind of interpret this, you brought in ethnographic methods, and so what did that allow you to do that maybe a strict historical approach would not have?
So this is a quarrel that I have with Paul Harvey as to whether it's ethnographic methods or if I'm just an intellectual historian. I tend to think ethnographic methods. He tends to think that this is just sort of an intellectual historical model. But I think what ethnography provides that I didn't find in social historical or cultural historical methods is that it provides a way of understanding and writing culture from different perspectives that tends to be dialogical. It tends to try to evoke atmosphere, right, and create, do the best that we can to recreate worlds, right, which is what historians do, of course, as well. But it gave me a way to think through also the ethics of working on unloved groups in a way that I felt didn't exist in historical methods, right? It gave me a sort of sensitivity to the ethics of presentation and how I needed to understand my authorial voice different than the voices of the people that I was studying. And it allowed me just a sort of richness that I didn't think I would find otherwise. It also means that I pretty much ignore chronology. Except, you know, in the book, I mean that it's very much sort of a deep analysis of themes like whiteness or gender or nation or Protestantism that have, you know, time signpost, but it's not sort of the chronological history that's the common one of the Klan. Rather, it's like, if we get really embedded in here, what do we see? And that's the thing that I think ethnographic methods allow me in a way that gave me a theoretical approach that I might not have had if I had just said the Klan starts in 1915, right? And they light a cross on fire, which I tell this narrative, right? But then I say, like, this is part of it. The other part of it is, if we're going to understand appeal, right, the elusive appeal of these movements, let's see what they're sort of imagining. And what I would say here, of course, is that that's kind of a dangerous method, too, because it's not like I can be a mind reader of 1920s Klansmen, but I do have this sort of richness of these documents that get me closer to that, I think.
And one of the things they're imagining is Christian knighthood, and I want to ask you about that, because I'm wondering, first, why are they recovering this medieval image,
right,
a Protestant group, and what does this say about the Klan's take on masculinity in general, masculinity?
I mean, it's this kind of funny thing where the other thing that doesn't happen in Klan historiography is there's not necessarily gendered analysis sometimes of this. There's a lot about how the Klan sees women. There's not a lot about how the Klan sees men. So one of the things that I was really fascinated by that sort of turned me on to trying to understand the masculinity of this fraternal order is their discussions of martyrdom, right, and like broken masculine bodies in this really graphic, very disturbing way that's also in tandem with this vision of these valiant, like, white knights. And I mean, of course, the sort of romantic image works so well with the supremacist image here of these men who are just going to save everything, right? Like, all America needs is for white men to just sort of beef up, right? Throw on these robes and then sort of gallantly move in and do this. And what I found there too was interesting, because at the same time that they're parroting this like hyper masculinity, right, and this value and ideal that they can't possibly stick to, there's profound discomfort, right, about what this masculine role means. And so they spend a lot of time parsing language, right? So, you know, you should be sweet like Jesus, but sweet means that you're tough, right? Like that sweetness should not be equated with feminineness or something like that. And so for me, it was interesting that they would conjure an image of knights, as you said, a clearly kind of medieval, chivalrous thing that was also circuited through Reconstruction Klan visions too, right? And the image that they work with is just so kind of stoic and tough and yet vulnerable. I mean, it's this hilarious kind of mishmash of characteristics that I imagine might have driven Klansmen crazy, because it was just kind of an impossible thing to sort of work towards. And they're continually policing this masculine behavior, right? Like, I know some of you think that bad language is masculine. It's not, right? Watch your mouths, you know? But it's this kind of this interesting back and forth that the print allows us to see, right? That the kind of niceness of the print culture, I think, sometimes is we assume that the official version will just be kind of a smoothed over version in which everything works out. And I think what I show is that actually the official version shows a lot of kind of nervousness over changing social norms about gender, right, how women are supposed to react, that white knights have to save vulnerable women, and then you have women of the KKK who refuse to be vulnerable women, and, you know, the sort of interplay.
Go with that. Tell us about the women of the KKK who refuse to be vulnerable women, because that is a curious development in this story.
I mean, it's this kind of interesting moment where the male order imagined that there were all these women that were interested. So if they created an order for them, that they would just fall in line and be supportive. And what happens instead is that the women, especially the women who are responsible for the national leadership of the WKKK, take this as a moment to actually say, well, you know, I understand that we're helpmeets, and we are helpmeets, but you have to get us the vote. And if you want this to really be a white Protestant nation, then you need white women voting. You know, you say that you're going to do these things on the national level, yet you haven't done them yet. That's curious. So it becomes actually a vehicle for these women involved to not only supposedly support, but also actively pursue their own agendas. That they're very interested in suffrage. They're very interested in temperance in these different ways. And despite the fact that they can play with this language and use it to their advantage to say, oh, we are vulnerable, but you need to step up, right? I mean, it's this kind of continual back and forth between them, so that Robbie Gill, who becomes the imperial commander, has these incredible speeches where she says, men, I know you're men, and I know that it's a lot for you to listen to poor little old me, but I'm telling you, you're falling down on your job. I mean, so it's this kind of hilarious rhetorical gesturing where I found her in the archives, and I was like, this is incredible that you see this very avid use of kind of a vulnerable white womanhood, but to what is almost a feminist gesture, which is really different. So that the WKKK doesn't end up doing anything that the mail order really wants them to. So it means that the print then has all of these men complaining about women gone awry, right? That won't actually support them the way that they should, right? The danger of mothers to their white Protestant men, right? Who will force them into all of these all terrible positions. But I mean, this kind of battles that they had in print and in speeches and words, I think really evokes the complexity of an order like this, right? That it's not simply men are in charge and women follow, but rather they're dynamic interactions.
So on this print battle, a print battle that you get into is this riot at
Notre
Dame. My favorite
chapter.
In 1924. And it's a horribly confusing thing because there's so many versions. So what's your reconstruction of this, and how did it get used in Klan constructions of identity?
So what I should say is that, hands down, this is my most favorite thing I've ever written as a scholar. Like, it was so difficult to sort of actually get an accurate sort of rendering of the events. Like, I spent a lot of time looking at South Bend newspapers and then Klan newspapers and then print from Notre Dame, and all of them had very kind of interesting versions of this. So basically what happens is that the Klan decides unwisely that they're going to march in South Bend. The president of Notre Dame warns his male Notre Dame students, right, that we cannot actually participate in this, right? We will not bow to their level. Of course, what happens is that several Notre Dame students can't resist the urge and find a couple spare Klansmen just hanging around. They terrorize them. There's one really great image that I use in the book of a student who ripped a Klan robe off of a Klansman and then puts it back on himself. So it's this white Catholic guy, right, now wearing the robe in kind of this drag-esque fashion. And so what happens is, and I think the way this chapter works really effectively is, I say that, you know, this riot occurs, and basically there are Klansmen and Notre Dame students beating each other in the streets of South Bend, right? Only the rain stops them. And so what it does is it actually actualizes all the fears that Klan had about Catholics, right? So they had lingering suspicion about so-called Romanists, right, or Papists who are going to take over. And in this instance, they say, look, on our own soil, our American soil — they ignore, of course, the Catholics are American — on our American soil, right, Catholics are attacking us. This is everything we've said. So then in the follow-up sort of pamphlet, right, the truth about Notre Dame, they go through all of this effort to say Notre Dame started it, right? These evil Catholics that are then supported by the government, right, and civil institutions started it, and all we wanted to do was bring them our Protestant love. Like, all we want to do is rally, which of course is not why they're rallying, right? But all we want to do is do this, and then they did these terrible, terrible things. And my favorite instance in the pamphlet is they talk about how one supposed eyewitness sees a Notre Dame student pick a baby out of a baby carriage and slap it across the face and then toss it to its mother. I found this in the archives, and I thought, like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, because it's just an incredibly crazy story, right? Like, this, you know, it's one of those things where I'm like, this couldn't have possibly happened. But it's hilarious that they would gesture to this. And what we find out, right, is that it's a woman who put a flag on a baby carriage, and they saw the flag and were so incensed that they're attacking infants, and it was a female infant, right? So it's like they layer on the insults for this. And it's this moment where all of this rhetorical angst that they had is actually embodied, that they say, look, we have proof now. Like, we were correct. We are the ones that are being victimized. So it's the kind of pinnacle of my book, because it shows, like, they're worried. And then when these actions happen, right, it proves to sort of justify everything that they've been claiming already. And they go through a lot of effort in this. Notre Dame also goes through a lot of effort in this to say what really happened is that patriotic Americans stood up to be patriotic. So the narration on both sides is really fascinating. And I think it also shows how complicated intolerant rhetoric is, that it's not just we dislike you or we despise you, but rather there's all this kind of shifting, right, of understanding that the Klan is actually about tolerance and Notre Dame's not, right? And that they're able to make this work kind of fluidly, actually, in the way that they're describing this. So it was one of those chapters that I spent a lot of time on trying to sort of think about, like, how exactly do I present this material, right? And whose side do I take? And what I end up doing is having one version and the other and say, somewhere in between this, right, we've got a real rendering of this. But it becomes that significant moment, right, where the Klan is able to say, everything we've said is justified. And I think that that's a really powerful story to tell, right, to say that sometimes this rhetoric leads to violence, sometimes this violence actually affirms, right, that it could be something separate that then affirms a previous position.
So these issues of tolerance, of pluralism, of nativism are still very much alive today. And
yes.
So in your afterword, you jump ahead, and you're reluctant to do that.
I am.
But you do. So talk about your reluctance in jumping ahead, and what kind of conclusions did you come to when looking at our present situation?
Yeah, it's one of these funny things where historians, I think, we're continually trained to be very good at posturing backwards, right? That we need all the facts in front of us, and we want to have all the data we can to sort of make the claims that we do. And even when we make those claims, they're very careful claims, right? About, this is what I think about this from the fragments that I can tell. So when the press presented me with the opportunity to write an afterword, I was like, I'm not sure I could talk about the contemporary, right? Like, I'm not sure I'm trained in a way to make this work. And the press insisted that I was indeed trained to do this, and I told them, I said, okay, so I will attempt this and see what I can do. And it just happened that this coincided with a rise in hate groups. It coincided with Glenn Beck, right, having these rallies where he's standing in the same place as Martin Luther King Jr. and claiming, right, that he is the heir of the civil rights movement. So it sort of, I mean, it's one of those moments where I was like, wow, the present is actually the same as the past. You know, I had this kind of like, oh, wow, it's kind of an intriguing way that this works. So I picked a couple case studies, but I didn't play them out in the ways that I think people would have expected me to. So that there was a common association between Terry Jones and who's the pastor in Florida who did burn a Quran day, who's still in the news, remarkably so. You know, that what people wanted to make this easy thing between, like, burning Qurans and burning crosses, and it doesn't work, right? That Terry Jones is not doing this in the same way that the Klan is, and that Glenn Beck, though he seems like a natural inheritor of this, right, and that there's a impulse to say that he somehow is, that's not the entire story either, but that he is part of a larger brand of political rhetoric that I think the Klan allowed to be engendered. And so for me in the contemporary, it's thinking about the way that this Klan conflation of whiteness and Christian identity and nationalism is then repackaged in the 21st century. And that you can find it in the evocation of Glenn Beck, right, who's claiming this different type of history and trying to do this in this way. And I think that's really important. And it's also important for the contemporary to understand why in this moment would that rhetoric appeal again, right? Like, what is it about this moment that allows this to happen? And so at the end, I was finally happy with the afterword, still reluctant about me talking about the present in any kind of way like this. But I mean, it's a really interesting kind of thing to take our historical case studies and try to apply them to the present, because I have a deep hesitance about whether we can actually move in time and space so cleanly. And I don't think we can. I think we can find echoes, which is different.
Okay, well, just one last question before we go. You are working on a cultural history of zombies. So I'm just, you got to tell me how we get from the Klan in the 1920s to a cultural history of zombies.
White supremacy. That's the easy answer. So part of what is happening with this cultural history of zombies is I'm trying to trace how this monster is crafted from around 1932 actually to the present, and how that's related to issues of both domestic social change, but also to think about the sort of larger global world. And one of the things that I'm intrigued by is how popular culture envisions society. So one of the things with the Zombie Project is to look at how different creators in different moments have envisioned zombies and how they provide visions of the American nation. So I can't get away from nationalism. I never thought I would work on nationalism, and now I can't actually step away from it. So that I'm very interested in what happens in these kind of zombie apocalypse moments, right? What does society look like after supposed tragedy and catastrophe? What do the zombies look like? Why are they more multicultural than our heroes, right? What are the kinds of ethics of survival that become present, right? And part of this comes directly out of my teaching, where my students, who I love deeply, sometimes tend to be very uncritical of popular culture and sort of imagine that they consume it and it doesn't actually impact them. But I'm really toying with ideas of how pop culture serves as ethical and moral training too, right? So what are the sort of things that are going on here that are different? So basically I'm moving from print to sort of pop in this, but again to think through really carefully of what religion's role is in this, right? Where does religion come in? How do people use religious reasoning to justify action, right? What is the role of violence in this? So it's a very deeply ethical project, which makes me kind of nervous. But again, sort of continuing some of those strands that I picked up in that first book.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and we look forward to seeing it. And with that, I think we'll conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Gospel According to the Klan, the KKK's Appeal to Protestant America, 1915 to 1930. Thank you to Kelly Baker for joining us. You can keep tabs on Kelly at her website, www.kellyjbaker.com. And while you're at it, click on over to the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu. There you can listen to this and other podcasts, subscribe to our iTunes feed, or join us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.